Professor Trimble was the head of the European Union Law Unit in the Ministry of Justice in the Czech Republic. She's a prolific author. I bring her latest book, published by Oxford University Press. And with that, Professor Trimble.
Thank you very much.
Yay!
Welcome. Thank you for coming to listen to my talk about the highs and lows of empirical research in law. I would like to thank Professor Price for organizing this series, which I like very much, because it's like one of my friends told me she has a newborn baby, and she told me that she has all these people asking her, so what do you do at home all day? I mean, you're stuck there, what are you doing? And I feel like with law professors, it's sometimes the same. Students see us, you know, during class, and then they wonder, what do these people do for the rest of the day? So I welcome this opportunity to share what we do for the rest of our days. So thank you also for joining us on Washington's birthday. And some of you might have wondered why Professor Price brought up that connection. And it is indeed because George Washington was the president who signed our first patent law in 1790. And the first patent law was, we could say, somewhat naive in that it expected the president personally to sign every single patent that will issue. So here is the copy of the patent number one from 1790 with personal signature of George Washington. So that's the connection. So highs and lows of empirical research in law. Empirical research in law is a popular thing. And there are some highs and also some lows to tell you about. I will give you some examples from my own little empirical research that I did on patent litigation. And my other examples will be also from other areas of intellectual property law, patents and copyright, which are the two areas of IP that I work in. I am in general interested in transnational or international issues in patents and copyrights. And as you can imagine, with the rise of the internet, we see more and more of these issues coming up. So, let me start by making a few introductory remarks to empirical research. Of course, empirical research in general plays a very important role in any kind of policy making, policy crafting, and of course, we would hope that most of our policies are based on some kind of empirical evidence. So when you think of voting rights, right, and the demographical information that we use for that, in criminology, right, the impact of sociology and other empirical sciences. But also we see use of empirical research in evidence. And here you might immediately think of things like fingerprinting or some other evidence that's being used in criminal matters. But in fact, in intellectual property, we have some examples too. For instance, surveys are regularly used as evidence to show the likelihood of confusion in trademark law. So that would be another example. And finally, we see empirical research in law as an issue of research. There has been this desire for law to become some kind of exact science, right? So the old idea of the old law professor covered with dust in the law library was apparently not the way to go for the modern society. Certainly movements such as legal realism, or later movements such as law and society, or law and economics, have generated a lot of interest in empirical research. With law and economics, in addition to that, law academia was able to attract a lot of empiricists, people who were trained in statistics and economics, and could actually help with their knowledge in those areas. But certainly the idea here is that legal research should not be only doctrinal, that it should not be written from closed offices in some dusty buildings, but that people should get out of the library and see what's out there in the world and really reflect what's going on in real life. In addition to that, and we cannot deny that, what propelled the interest in empirical research in particular U.S. academic circles is the fact that law schools began to hire people either with dual degrees or with non-legal degrees. So they started hiring people who have PhDs in sociology, in economics, and so forth. And those people were certainly well equipped to start various types of cross-disciplinary or interdisciplinary projects. On the other hand, I should also emphasize that it would be a mistake to think that this interest in empirical research has been limited to academia. So there are certainly many practitioners, and particularly in intellectual property, who are extremely interested in intellectual property research. As one example, so that I start with some practical examples, at the last conference called DEFCON, which is the largest computer hackers conference in the world, one computer hacker, who now is a law student in a named law school, conducted this fascinating empirical research. He uses a website that has all the recordings of all oral arguments before the Supreme Court, and he codes it in various ways, and he tries to predict, based on the oral argument, what the result will be, what the decision of the Supreme Court will be. And just to explain what the practical impact of that is, he's trying to come up with some kind of betting system, right, that would actually allow people to bet on the result of the Supreme Court case, which can go very beyond gaming, of course, and it's very important for people who want to invest in securities. So that would be one of these examples. But the fact is, and that's undeniable, that unless your paper looks like this, or potentially like this, you have very little chance to have your legal paper published in a highly ranked legal journal. So the fact is that, you know, this type of text is very welcomed by various law journals, and people try very hard to come up with topics for the law review articles that allow them to use regression analysis and show statistical significance and so forth. The question is, does this really make our scholarship more relevant? We started with the premise that we don't want all these dusty law professors locked up in their offices writing about things that are irrelevant. The question is this more relevant to a judge who sits on a district court and needs to decide a case, right? Maybe not. Certainly, Chief Justice Roberts last summer uttered a few words on C-SPAN about legal scholarship that again generated a lot of discussion about this. And one of the professors who responded to him actually criticized law schools for pushing people into this dual degree cross-disciplinary scholarship that calls for the analysis of this type without really considering practical significance of that scholarship. So it's, you know, it's still the same story. It's legal scholarship trying to be relevant and yet uncover new features that can shape our policies in the future. One problem is that people don't realize that empirical research is not limited to statistical analysis, not at all. When we talked about empirical research in law, we talked not only about statistical or quantitative research, but also about qualitative research that can be built on interviews or other forms of research. So there are also various areas where you can conduct your research. It can certainly be about certain economic or societal features that should underpin our policies. We can also conduct some interesting research about courts and litigation, right? And I will talk about some types of that research later. You can also research functioning of the judicial system, right? And court system, prison system, and so forth. Of course, a crucial point in your research is defining your research question. And that's something that many of us hate, because one of the beauty of empirical research is that you remain open. Like, and you see what's out there, and you figure out what to write about first when you see the data and when you see some of the results. But of course, it would be a mistake to go out there being completely blind. So it would be ideal to have at least some idea about what you are trying to research. Again, you might be very successful at avoiding the question if nobody wants you to ask it, right? If you are not asking for a grant, or if you are not writing a paper for one of the obsessed professors as I am, you know, you don't might be not need a research question, but I would urge you to think about it. Funding. Again, empirical research, particularly if you decide to collect data by yourself, can be extremely expensive. And here, of course, one thing is to consider how much time you want to spend on chasing funding, but also I think what cannot be underestimated is some consideration of the impact of your results on what you are trying to achieve. Sometimes anecdotal evidence provided in a skillful way, right, presented in a skillful way, might be much more effective than some statistical analysis of thousands of cases that might actually not work all that well. Another interesting hurdle you might encounter if you do research, particularly if you are a counsel or a researcher within some research institution, is human subject approval. So because of some very unfortunate experience that we had in the United States, universities and other research institutions do require researchers to submit their research to an approval if they consider interviewing human subjects. Of course, there the major problem is who your subjects are and what is the subject of your research. But you would be surprised. My own experience shows that it might strike at a very surprising moment. I asked the one research board for an approval of my research at the same time when one of my colleagues asked for an approval to do interviews with women who were raped, and the question she wanted to ask concerned the criminal act. However, those women were all in Haiti. While I wanted to interview patent attorneys in the Bay Area. And guess who ended up having problems with the Human Research Board approval? Me, right? Because of course the University Council called me and said, oh my God, we will be subpoenaed the next day for all your records. Make sure you destroy them. So that was legally possible. So that can be challenging. The other part is, of course, if you end up, which is of course extremely appealing, doing some research with other countries. So if you get connected with researchers in other countries, it can be very complicated because, of course, you want their research to compare to your understanding of ethical issues in research. But they might have their own human research board. They might have some other approvals you have to go through. And what's usually surprising to US researchers is their data protection rules might be much stricter than are ours. So you might encounter, particularly in Europe, the need to get approval from data protection officers who can be very strict and also very careful when it comes to researchers from other countries. So that can be, again, a very challenging issue. You cannot underestimate attorney-client privilege issues if you want to interview lawyers, right? Some of them are very happy to share with you even more than you ever want to hear, so maybe it is a good idea to consider how long you want to keep your records and in which form and so forth. Data sources, that's another story, right? So finding good data sources can be also challenging, and here, of course, I would actually argue that the old dusty library can be actually a very, very good, not only starting point, but sometimes even the point that where you are headed. If you want to do any kind of research on litigation, of course, PACER for federal courts would appear to be the right place to start. The problem with PACER, at least as I understand it, and maybe our librarians will correct me, is that its searching capability is very limited. Even the searching that it provides, which is based on coding given by the courts, is extremely unreliable. And so it's very difficult to base any kind of research on that, unless you already know which cases you're looking for. Of course, Westlaw, LexisNexis are great resources, but you have to be very careful about what kind of conclusions you can make from those, right? So there's a lot of research out there, empirical research, that is based on data from Westlaw and LexisNexis. Frustratingly, those databases include, of course, published cases, but also unpublished cases. But apparently not all, either. So, and I haven't been very successful in finding out who decides which ones adapt from Westlaw and which ones don't. Anyway, fine, but you have to be very careful how you limit your conclusions, right? You have to define what the conclusions actually concern. If you want to show something that, in light of what courts, judges themselves, want to present to the public, published cases are excellent, right? But if you want to conduct, for instance, some research on recognition and enforcement of foreign judgments, that might be tricky. Because those cases are often filed with federal courts, with the lowest federal district courts, and that might be indeed very difficult. Also, what the huge problem here is, if you want to really capture the entire universe of legal disputes, think about how many things don't get filed in courts. You might have to do interviews, you might have to talk to lawyers, you might have to talk to parties, right? And you might have to use other sources to get those kind of data. People have tried really hard to get settlements data, right? Data on settlements that often are not public and parties actually guard quite rigorously. So that might be another problem. So just to give you an example, for my research, for instance, Westlaw was completely useless from right at the beginning because my interest was in the volume of cases filed in the U.S. that involve foreign parties and therefore present a potential problem for recognition and enforcement of judgments abroad. So I was lucky because I got to use this very cool database that's called Lex Machina, and if any of you are headed to practice IP law, you should know about this database. It's run by a startup that started at Stanford Law School, and what they do is they have complete dockets of all patent cases filed in the United States, I believe, since 2000. It's complete docket access that goes beyond PACER, meaning even if you have access to PACER, this database has more. What they did was they actually chased some poor graduate students to courts that didn't use PACER when PACER started, or started later, and also to courts that were not really diligent about attaching documents, and they scanned all the dockets. So you can actually get PDF with the documents that are to the docket. So it's perfect. It's also coded, but of course, as empirical research happens, it was not coded for what I needed, right? So I ended up going through many patent lawsuits. So when it comes to foreign sources, it's even trickier because even though some countries have LexisNexis, right, LexisNexis Germany, courts in other judicial systems in other countries have different approaches to publishing their decisions. Certainly in civil law countries, there is not natural need to publish decisions because they don't have case law, right? They are supposed to be guided only by statutes, which of course in practice doesn't work. Courts today are not silly, right? If they see that the Supreme Court is sending something back, they will make sure that next time they send a similar case up there, they don't get burned again. So that's actually not what's going on the ground, and even in civil law countries, we see more and more courts actually publishing their decisions. So for instance, for my research, I needed access to German decisions in patent cases. There's no database that would give you that. But you can find this interesting, one of the sources I used was Düsseldorfer Archive, which is interesting because it covers courts that are very active in the area of patents. So both the Düsseldorf Landgericht, the München Landgericht, are among those courts. Of course, when you look at the decisions, of course, the first problem is the language. So, you know, if you do want to do research on foreign litigation, better pick some country where you can deal with the language. But another problem that you might notice here is The name of the case is Kupplungsvorrichtung, which is actually the title of the patented invention. It has no names of the parties. And that's the case in most European countries, that if they publish decisions, they are anonymized. So you don't get the names of the parties, which in my case was quite a tragic thing because I needed to figure out who the parties are, to figure out whether they are foreign or German and so forth. So that can be another challenge that you might face if you decide to do research on these issues in other countries. Another problem is what you do with the volume of data. So I figured very early on that I wanted to go through 5,000 plus patent cases, and of course it looked like I will never finish. So the question is, should you consider hiring someone? Should you consider having a research assistant or student or somebody to help you out? And it's a very tricky thing because, of course, as you go through your research, there are a lot of small decisions you have to make, right? So in my case, it was nationality, place of incorporation of the plaintiff and the defendant, right? And sometimes it was tricky, right? You had to decide, okay, what to do with subsidiaries of big multinational companies. How will you deal with that? And also, this some kind of outsourcing does deprive you of part of the joy of the research, and that's finding the fun stuff, right? So let's face it. At the end, at one point, it becomes very daunting going through all these data and everything. And you know, I saw 5,000 of these, right? Mm-hmm. So I certainly can write a patent complaint, but. You know, it's nothing exciting. If you're lucky, you will get the IGT versus Wallis, right? And that's how, you know, what about the most exciting thing you get? But then you get these guys. This is a page, the first page of a complaint. I deleted the last paragraph because it included the cell phone number of the plaintiff. This one actually has a defendant, the Hoover Company. But this is an actual first page, right? I have another page from another complaint, which I actually love. I love the last sentence. Well, you've done it to me for the last 12 years. I have no idea what. So this is, by the way, the size of the page. It's like page 3 of the complaint, and he used font 42 or whatever, right, to make his point. Of course, what fascinates me as a person who was trained originally in civil law system is that in civil law countries, this will never appear in a docket, right? This will not go beyond the clerk. The clerk will just throw it at you and say, hire a lawyer, come back. What it fascinates me about US system is that this will not be turned away. Courts dealt with this. There are like 50 more additional docket documents after this one, right? And the court did a lot of work to dismiss this. But it was very serious, even though the defendants in this case were the officers of the United States. So, you know, that's fascinating. The same thing applies for patents, right? So, I didn't really have a reason to go through patent applications or patent descriptions for all the inventions in my patent complaints, but, you know, sometimes you hit someone, you know, like, well, wait a second, I really want to see the description for this one. So, you know, this one is from the IGT versus Wallis, complain, but then, you know, you get these, yes, right? This was patented in 1993, and it's a turkey lifter. Don't ask me, you know, I don't know what it is for, but it lifts the turkey. Another one that I like is this one. You would not believe how much money was spent on litigating infringement of this idiotic patent. It's a patent for a Christmas tree stand.
I think I have that tree stand.
It was patented in 2003 because it folds, and apparently ours didn't fold. Some Chinese company, of course, managed to make knockoffs, and it was litigated. Serious litigation. And what I have won for Professor Price, which is, of course, her favorite for my research, and then the light cube. Again, an incredible amount of money spent on litigating the infringement of a light cube that you might know. It's the very innovative product that blinks. It's a cube you can put in your freezer, and then you can drop it in your drink, and it blinks, right? So you have blinking drink.
They actually use those in the bars. Yeah. Your revolver was in the bars. The casino actually puts them in their server drinks, so when they're walking around, you can see them.
Amazing. Well, the location was actually quite interesting because I talked to the inventor of this one, and he is from the U.S. And the company that infringes his patent and trademark and copyright in this is in Canada. But it's owned by a U.S. citizen who moved to Canada to infringe, right? This is the infringer haven. So, again, incredible how much money they were able to spend on this. Now, probably the most difficult or most controversial point of empirical research in law is interpreting the results. So, you know, I don't think that people doubt that many of the law researchers are very diligent when they collect their data, when they run the programs with regression analysis and so forth. But sometimes when you read the conclusions about the research, that's where it sometimes doesn't seem to work very well. So, one problem that I see is that people are not willing to be modest. They start out with a big research question and they want this huge, groundbreaking result. Sometimes if you stick to what you really found, it might be surprising enough. Regression analysis, trying to find some causal effect in law, might be exciting. Right. For instance, Judge Moore, who sits on the Federal Circuit Court, she did a research in 2002 or 3 where she tried to prove bias of juries against foreign defendants in patent litigation. So her idea was if the infringer, alleged infringer, is a foreign company, the result is more likely in favor of the plaintiff. Perfect case for regression analysis, and it works, right? She actually, poor girl, found out that there is no way to prove that there is bias. But, you know, she reported that, and that's certainly a very good result to know about. The same thing about statistical significance. You know, does it make really sense to look for statistical significance of wrongful convictions? I mean, if we have one person wrongfully executed in 1,000, do we care whether it's statistically significant or not? There are a lot of things in law that matter, even if it's one isolated example. So while it might matter in many cases and certainly has its place, again, one has to be careful about that. Context is very important. I will show you one example later that will document that. So again, you know, policy implications, results, that's all extremely important. So let me show you some examples. This is from my own research, and I love this one because it's a great example of how you can present true data in a way that's completely misleading by using a specific type of chart, right? So by using this tilted chart and putting the 5 and 10% in front of everybody, it looks, well, it's still only 5 and 10%, right? But it looks like, oh my God, that's a real problem out there. Well, I think it is because of this number of cases which involve either foreign defendant only, which is 5% in patent litigation, or U.S. and foreign defendants together. But again, presentation matters. One thing about context is it is very important to do your research in advance. So, for instance, when you line up, how many are they? 8 busiest district courts as far as patent litigation, it's certainly good to know that while, you know, in case of Central District of California or Northern District of California or Northern District of Illinois, we see the obvious reason why those districts would be heavy in patent litigation. You know, what about Eastern District of Texas and Eastern District of Pennsylvania? Well, in Texas, if you do some reading and look around, you find out that, in fact, Eastern District of Texas has been a very popular destination for patent plaintiffs. It's a very good court to find your patent infringement lawsuit. So that would be understandable just by doing some reading. But what about Pennsylvania, right? So we have seen no significant patent activity in Eastern District of Pennsylvania before 2004. And frankly, not even after 2004. So what happened there? And that's where context is very important, and we're digging into the data. And again, maybe a good reason why you don't want to outsource a lot of the data processing. is very important. And it turns out that in 2004, one plaintiff was crazy and filed like 70 lawsuits, right, in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. There, because that's where they are incorporated, that's where they have their corporate headquarters. So nothing mysterious about that, right? But it's important to make that footnote and to explain how you ended up with this result. So when I did this, again, I was interested in the increase in number of patent cases that involve foreign defendants. And you can see from the comparison of 2 years, which of course don't show any kind of trend, right? There are only 2 points in history, but it suggested that there was an increase in foreign defendants that would be of any significance in the District of Delaware, District of New Jersey, and Eastern District of Texas. So the question was, well, what is behind that, right? And I could simply state, well, you know, we see more foreign defendants showing up, more defendants being sued. Well, you know, when you look into the detail, oh, that's interesting. You see very interesting things, right? So in District of Delaware, when you look at who the defendants are, which countries they are from, you very quickly see that the greatest increase in 2009 compared to 2004 was in defendants from India and Israel. What do those countries have in common, right? Well, big generic pharma industries. So it turns out that the entire increase in 2009 compared to 2004 was caused by very specific types of patent infringement lawsuits called ANDA or NDA lawsuits, where patent holders actually challenge new generic drugs that are not on the market yet, but that the generic companies are preparing to put on the market. So it's actually not, you know, everybody looked at my research and said, oh yes, finally you will show all these Chinese garage operations stealing our IP, right? Well, that's not the case. These are huge, this is Teva and others, right? Those are huge generic pharma companies that fight these lawsuits, and indeed that's confirmed in another chart. So what happened in the Eastern District of Texas? Well, there what was very interesting, when you broke down the data into defendants that were only foreign and defendants who were foreign and U.S., so co-defendants, you found out that the entire increase in 2009 compared to 2004 was in those co-defendant cases, in cases where you had both a U.S. defendant and a foreign. Well, and again, when you look at the history of the Eastern District of Texas, you will find out that courts, particularly circuit courts, get very tired of defendants, of plaintiffs running to the Eastern District of Texas to file lawsuits. And they try to correct it by changing rules for venue transfer. And sure enough, if you look deeply into the data and compare them with 2008, 2010, you will see exactly the pattern. The key decisions of the Fifth Circuit and also later the Federal Circuit Court, and how these cases with foreign defendants increased when the plaintiffs had some hope that this additional foreign defendants, their case will not be moved to another, will not be transferred to another court. So it was a very instrumental thing they were doing. And of course, we might say, well, yeah, but they didn't fabricate the foreign defendant, right? You still had to have some kind of relationship to the infringement. Well, yeah, but it's interesting, right? That's how the foreign defendant increase apparently happened. This is a chart that many people found interesting about the research, which was looking at number of cases with defendants from particular countries and how it compares from 2004 to 2009. So usually people are surprised that the greatest infringer by far when we look at patent litigation are Canadians, apparently, again. But when you look at the other countries involved, you can see great increase in Japan, India, China, Germany actually also. So you see some kind of development there. China and Hong Kong, interesting, right? When you break it down to declaratory judgment actions, meaning actions brought by alleged infringer against patent holder, you see only one of those actions and the rest of them were infringements. So this is, I think, what's very interesting about the research, which is it shows that there is not only a certain shift in the number of cases, but also in the nature of litigated patents. So while in 2004 we see a huge group of these cases that involve Christmas tree stands, sliding slides and other interesting patents, in 2009 we see increase in electronics, chemical patents, we see telecom rising and so forth, suggesting that maybe the weight of the litigation is shifting toward more serious patents, or at least patents that might have a greater economic impact for the U.S. than Christmas tree stands. I have nothing against Christmas tree stands. But, you know, again, going back to being truthful and honest about things, let's face it, we are talking about the difference between 9 and 28 cases, right? It's not in the thousands at all. And of course, we might wonder why, how come we don't see more Chinese defendants before U.S. courts? And I'm sure you're all quite aware of the answer, which is, well, even if you get a judgment against them, you will have to go to China in most instances and get it enforced there. And that's certainly not all that easy at all. So just to show you some other interesting examples of interesting empirical research in law, this is a Canadian research that concerns peer-to-peer file sharing. So of course the endless debate about is content industry losing anything because of peer-to-peer sharing? I'm surprised anybody needs any empirical evidence on that. I can show them my nephew, and clear enough, they are losing a lot of money on my nephew. But, you know, looking for empirical evidence. This is a Canadian study from 2006, and what they did was they conducted phone interviews. They selected, or they managed to reach about 1,000 Canadians who admitted they were engaging in peer-to-peer file sharing with content that appears to be illegal, and to about 1,100 Canadians who said they never do that. And they collected data on their spending for music, for DVDs, for films, and then they tried to estimate the loss to the industry. They came up, as you can see, with what is it, 1 billion something Canadian dollars. Well, as you probably all feel, this seems rather tricky, particularly going down to $1. But you know, it's some methodology, and they tried very hard. People keep trying to improve on this, right? So the research that I actually like much more is two guys, one I believe is Portuguese, which would explain why they have all the data breaking down for US and Portugal. and what they did was they did research on peer-to-peer file sharing based on very in-depth research of what's really going on in on peer-to-peer websites. So they were looking at BitTorrent swarms that include the material that they the kind of material that's not listed on sites that list the legal BitTorrent swarms. Just that you know, there is such a thing as legal BitTorrent sources. So anyway, so they looked only at the illegal ones, right? And they also watched the traffic, so the volume of data being transmitted from those swarms. And, you know, they came up with interesting statistics showing that indeed movies seem to be the most requested, desired content on these, songs being the second, software third, but games being, you know, quite not as popular, books apparently not such a big deal yet. So that's interesting. They also looked, they did that for about 106 days, and they looked at the most popular content by far. So you can see Rihanna up there, twice even. So they looked at the most popular songs during those 106 days, and what really surprised them was that in fact, 37 song titles accounted for half of all song transferred. So in the 106 day or whatever period, in fact, half of the transfers were only 37 songs. They did the same thing for movies, with Toy Story 3 being on top of the list. And they found out that about 117 movies accounted for half of all the movies transferred on BitTorrent. So that's certainly a more precise and certainly more comforting result that we have. The question is, again, how much can we conclude about the loss to the industry? I'm sure nobody would claim that every single person who got a movie through BitTorrent would have gone out and bought a DVD. So we are still back to the same problem. Also, the finding that only 37 songs accounted for half of the traffic, that's really amazing and fascinating, but how much does it do for us, right? Even if it were one song, what would it mean for the future of copyright law? That's a really difficult thing to say. Maybe it makes more sense or means more for the content holders who can decide how much money they want to spend on lobbying. So another interesting research, and a huge group of empirical research in IP concerns non-practicing entities. So you might have heard about them, so-called patent trolls. They are the entities who usually don't engage in any kind of research, or if they do, it's very limited. And they are in the business of buying other people's patents and enforcing them, in a very aggressive way. So as compared to, for instance, universities or other research institutions who might also not be practicing their inventions, these non-practicing entities are very aggressive. They try to extort high licensing fees by threatening litigation and so forth. So it's a very discomforting feature of current patent litigation landscape, and courts and Congress have tried very hard to limit the activities of these non-practicing entities. So again, one of our colleagues conducted an interesting research on the presence of patent trolls in patent litigation, how much of a problem it really is. And again, you can see that in 2007, 81 lawsuits, 2.9% of all patent lawsuits in the United States filed by non-practicing entities. Well, first of all, there is a very difficult definition, as you can imagine, of who a non-practicing entity is. Who are these mean patent trolls, right? I suggest in one time it should be very easy. It should be any organization that has its principal place of business in Taylor, Texas, and has only 3 employees. I mean, how far, you know. But clearly that's not the case, right? Intellectual ventures, I don't think, have anything in Taylor, Texas. And they could be, arguably, considered a non-practicing entity of a troll type. So that's one problem of the research, right? How do you draw the line? And when I looked at the list of patent trolls, I saw some interesting names missing on that. And that, of course, preceded the litigation against people who called someone patent troll, and they actually filed lawsuit against them. But again, what does this mean, right? If we have 2.9% of lawsuits filed by patent trolls, does it mean it's less of a problem for patent litigation, for patent policies? That's a question, right? Similarly, the empirical results about success in these lawsuits by these entities is very interesting, right? So you can see, compared to the general population of patent lawsuits, that in fact it seems like fewer cases are settled, but not by that far. And again, what does it tell us, right? What is the meaning of this? That might be difficult. Even trickier is interpreting your results about courts. If you want to do any kind of research that might suggest anything about behavior of judges, be very careful. They love to comment on that. So, for instance, one of my colleagues did this interesting empirical research about behaviors of circuit courts. So he compared percentages of dissents among the various circuits. And he found out that indeed Ninth Circuit and the Federal Circuit seem to have a very high percentage of dissents. What does it mean, right? Well, interestingly enough, the judges on the Federal Circuit Court actually had a very interesting explanation for this, which is when the Federal Circuit Court was established, The idea was that it will unify jurisprudence concerning patent law. And some people were concerned that that will actually make the patent law weaker in the sense that we will not see these circuit splits on issues, that we will actually lose that. You will have only one appellate court, and what would have otherwise developed as splits between circuits will be lost. And so the judges on the Ninth Circuit apparently feel prompted to write dissents because they feel like it's their obligation to point out issues that would have otherwise arisen as an issue of circuit split. Again, percentages of dissents in patent cases very high in federal circuit cases on patents, but not in their other federal cases. So what to say in the conclusion? I think that empirical research in law is great and has wonderful future, and I try to encourage people who write papers with me to try to write about something that's outside the doctrinal world and go beyond Westlaw and LexisNexis, and I send all of them to our wonderful librarians who probably are abused every time because they know where they're coming from. But I think it's really wonderful if you look behind the letter of the law, behind what the courts are doing, and try to research that. It has its own limitations, and again, I think it is a challenge for legal scholarship to make sure that it didn't go all the way to the other side. We didn't want to look like these dusty professors who come up with these doctrines. But at the same time, we should make sure that when we do empirical research, we still are relevant to courts and we can actually bring something new and useful to them. Thank you.
I hope there's questions for Mr. Turnbull.
Questions? Any sort of questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what percentage of your time from the initial, when you thought of what you wanted to look at to the end, what percentage of your time was spent data gathering as opposed to looking at the results and writing?
Well, first of all, it is a circular process. So for most people, that's the way it works. Even if you do interviews, if you do data collection for statistical purposes, you do keep going back and seeing what's going wrong, seeing the patterns, seeing subsets of your data. So it would be actually very difficult to calculate, and I have to admit I never kept the timesheet to figure that out. But because I did all the coding myself and all the work, I would say that it was 95% spent on the Lex Machina database with the cases and everything. If I had to do it again, I would definitely ask research assistants to help me because it's just overwhelming to do it yourself. But I would miss those funny pro se plaintiffs. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw a lot of data on P2P. Mm-hmm. Something which interested me about some point. Can you explain why university presidents of top universities were completely absent and silent at the Supreme Court in the case of Rockstar, which was the final case which resolved what's to be done with the
university
PTP?
Presidents were absent.
And silent.
No.
In other words, there was no, they made no representations,
right,
to amicus briefs.
Well, the question would be, what kind of position should they have?
Exactly.
It's very tricky because I was actually one of the addressees of one of those scary emails. We notify you that you're using BitTorrent to transfer illegal files. It was not me, it was my nephew who was visiting, right? Who cares? So that was a scary email. But it is very tricky, right? Because certainly for university research institutions, all of us, there is this difficult dilemma of, on the one hand, we really want the content that we produce to be accessible to people. Mm-hmm. And for those of us who are lucky enough that we can actually produce writing, scholarship, and not being dependent on royalties. You know, we want to give it out for free. We want to see people reading it, right? We want to influence policies. We want to make sure it gets to people. At the same time, universities hope to get revenue from their patents. Universities don't want to see their books that they publish in their university presses to appear the next day online and be infringed. So I think it would be very difficult for a university president to have one-sided position on Grobster and those issues.
Well, the problem was, you know, we were looking for, when I was in the education department, we were looking for the voice of the university. And surprisingly, there was no voice of university administration. Even though there was a lot of activity outside of the court with respect to, you know, forming study groups and advisory groups which universities involved themselves with. So it was very strange, and that in fact inspired the topic of my dissertation of the absence and silence. And the only university personnel who actually put in amicus briefs were individual professors in their capacity as researchers, and the administrations were completely absent. So it was really curious
I think if you run your own internet network with clients who might be engaged in peer, maybe you don't want to weigh on a case that involves secondary liability. Yep.
This is fascinating. Thank you so much for presenting this. And I think you started with this, you know, again, the question that a lot of judges have, which is, what is the relevance of legal scholarship? And you showed quite a lot of data that suggests that judges, or, you know, maybe not in individual cases, but in their capacity as, you know, in terms of, like, setting the rules, you know, whether they be local rules. You mentioned, I think, one district sort of changing venue rules. So it, at least in this, in most of the data that you presented, you showed that it could be quite relevant in terms of, like, case management, and also a judge apparently that was concerned that foreign defendants were not getting fair jury trials, right? So I think you've shown, you know, you proved the premise that legal scholarship can be quite relevant to the court management, really, and forum shopping issues and all that. I'm wondering on the other, in other aspects of intellectual property, you referred a little bit to likelihood of confusion. Are courts less interested in that data? Is that the kind of data that has to come basically through an expert? Mm-hmm. And then the question is, does if it's a judge trial, you know, how much stock do they put in the expert? Or the court can just look at it themselves, and the judge can just say, well, I'm not confused, so I don't have to worry about this expert testimony, I discount it. Can you talk a little bit about other kinds of evidence and how it's used in the courts?
So the likelihood of confusion issue, right, there are expert witnesses who bring evidence about likelihood of confusion, and all you can do in those cases is to bring surveys. So they conduct surveys and try to show that consumers were confused or not by the other trademark, right, or not. And it's evidence like any other evidence in those cases. In all these infringement cases, certainly, there is a degree of empirical evidence that you bring, like any kind of evidence. So in copyright cases, courts might want to see that some data about the number of copies that were sold in a particular jurisdiction and so forth. Where I see an interesting line is where courts sort of learn new technologies and try to figure out how things work, right? So one area that fascinates me is personal jurisdiction on the internet. And the question of, well, should you base it on some vague sort of idea that, well, yeah, the defendant probably did something in this jurisdiction, we can sort of figure it out because the website is in the language of the jurisdiction, as opposed to realizing that there is data, real data, that they can use to show how many people access that website from that particular jurisdiction, how many actually purchased and downloaded the particular content. And that's fascinating, because courts seem to be very slow at learning about technology and using those kinds of data. And it's understandable, because of course all they can go by is expert testimony, and certainly the other side usually brings experts who will do anything to make sure that the court doesn't believe that that's actually a reliable source of data. So it will lag somewhat in the development.
I mean, is there also a way to judge sort of the impact of empirical research or legal scholarship at all, or not even just legal scholarship, but by like the citation to different articles, or whether some articles are much more cited, you know, is that a way, I guess, to measure the impact of?
You can, in IP cases, like for instance the venue issues and so forth, while judges are clearly aware of the empirical scholarship in that area, because they do often refer to it in conferences and talk to them privately, they actually are quite interested in the patent litigation patterns and what happens to the venue changes and so forth. You don't see those articles cited in court decisions, and you might wonder why, but you see them very rarely cited. Yes.
Talk a little bit more about where you might be able to obtain data sets. Recurrent frustration I've run into. I mean, even a lot of the data that's out there, you know, Westlaw or Pacer or RISNet, you know, they're in these separate silos. It's very difficult to extract large amounts of data and then, you know, run analysis on. Much less if you wanted to like cross-reference stuff between them. Where do you get the data? I mean, it's supposed to always be record, right?
Well, I actually don't feel very comfortable talking about it when I have actually experts in the room present with data sources.
Oh, okay.
But from what I can say is that that is indeed a very frustrating thing. And in fact, a lot of people will shape their research based on what kind of data they can access. So for instance, there's a lot of research and code research out there about decisions of the International Trade Commission. And if you look online, the result is obvious, right? They have like 80 cases per year. Decisions are all published online. It's very easy to extract them. Similarly, people love doing research on patents. The same thing. The USPTO database, even though when you look it up, it looks like 1980s, in fact works and provides a lot of data. So, yep, I can only agree. It's difficult. That's why the Lex Machina database is pretty good.
Are there similar databases for other areas of law?
I know that Stanford has another database for class action litigation in securities. And I know people have done some research on that. In IP, for instance, the Houston University Law Center has another database that has, I don't remember, but I know we looked at it because of the data about patent injunctions.
Or injunctions.
Yeah. Following the eBay case in 2006, right, a lot of people were interested in the percentage of likelihood of success of plaintiffs to obtain injunctions. And so the Houston Law Center, for instance, had a data set that followed the development of injunctions. But it's paradise in the U.S. compared to other countries. And in fact, in Germany, for instance, the Max Planck Institute is thinking about creating, replicating something like the Lex Machina database. But as you can imagine, it's very tricky, because if you don't have the names of the parties, any kind of cross-referencing is very complicated. And Jen Anderson helped me with at least one of the cases where we were chasing one particular case from Germany to England to the US, and it's very difficult to locate those cases because they might concern very often litigated patents, so searching by the patent number might not help. So that's really tricky.
And I'll just say, outside of judicial decisions, some scholars have actually worked with associations and purchased data sets. So, you know, it's the big mortgage lenders associations or insurance associations that have these enormous databases that they like to keep very confidential. But people have purchased parts of them and done research on them.
I tried to get access to the full 2004-2009 patent dockets in Germany. And I was at the courts, both in Düsseldorf and in Munich. I talked to the chief justices, and the result was the same in both cases, which is data protection rules are so strict there that they found it virtually impossible to get me access to the files.
You talked a little bit about human research on this, and I was just curious, on the law review, we were actually told by University Council that interviews aren't really a big issue. It's when you get into surveys and opinions and how you protect the individual. So I'm just curious how that would play out if you're talking to lawyers in the Bay Area about their practice.
Right. It is very tricky. And it's one of those things, if you don't bring it up, maybe nobody will notice. So, you know, so we have the extremes, right? We have my colleague who interviewed rape victims in Haiti, and there's no question about that, that if you're going to go out and ask victims about their experience, they fall into this category. I was more toward the end of the spectrum, although not at the very end, right? So. I want to talk to lawyers about specific types of cases that they were involved in, their experience. It is limiting when you start dealing with these human subject boards, because you might end up feeling very inhibited in asking anybody about anything, right? So suddenly you wonder, can I pick up the phone and call the inventor and ask him? I mean, is this suddenly an interview and I should have an approval, right? If you do have a research that includes systematic survey type, even open-ended questions, interviews, you should definitely run by the board. The worst that can happen, well, there are actually more things, but usually what happens is the board, unless you are me, apparently, the board will usually take it as the lowest level of scrutiny, where they really only sort of take notice, right? And they
cursory review.
Right.
Level.
Right, so, which doesn't work much, but, or they will tell you what you need to add and so forth. It's very tricky. Another colleague of mine did a very interesting survey research interviews with people who misuse social security system in Israel, right? So she would go to these people and ask them these questions about how they've been abusing the system, and of course the research board wanted her. The first thing to do is to tell them what she's doing, explain to them legally. I mean, right, so she had to get some kind of exception to those rules because she just couldn't get people to tell her stuff otherwise. But it is inhibiting, no question about that. And I understand the rules should be that law reviews should not accept articles that use human subjects as sources of information without having been approved.
That our institution has a very light touch to this, because I'm sure at Stanford, I mean, it's probably, they were concerned about all their own institutional interests and being at risk, and talk about, you know, institutions having a voice in these, you know, cases. I mean, they're very vocal when it comes to patents, and, you know, their own patents. They're very busy sort of litigating those and filing amicus briefs and all that. So it depends on the institution, I guess.
On the other hand, if you ever come to me to talk about directed research, I apologize in advance that you will hear this again, but what I always try to tell people is, you as law students have absolutely unique opportunity. You can sit down and write an email to anybody and tell them you are law students and you are doing your research and you are interested in what they are doing. And what's amazing is that many people in law are very excited about sharing their knowledge and experience, and they are very proud of what they are doing. And
you can actually get in touch with a lot of people in the area that you are interested in long before you are out there looking for jobs. So I try to encourage people who write directed research projects with me to do some kind of looking around, talking to people, because you can really start relationships that can last.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.